from across the field, gave Michael the take sign that Michael was supposed to give to Bobby. But instead of doing that, Michael called time, started walking toward the plate, motioned for Bobby to come up the line and talk to him. He could feel everybody on the field looking at him. He gave a quick look across to Mr. M in the first base coaching box, Mr. M giving him a look of his own, like, what's going on here? Michael would have told him if he could. He was getting into the game. The umpire said, let's not turn this into a chat room, boys, especially if this baby's about to go extra innings. Even the ump didn't think Bobby had a chance to do anything against Corey Allen. I just want to go through the signs with him real quick, Michael said. Michael put his hands on Bobby's shoulders as a way of focusing him, the way grown-up coaches did when they had a conference like this. Bobby was a head smaller than he was, small and fast, a much better soccer player than he was a baseball player. In a quiet voice, Michael said, Corey's getting tired. Bobby said, he'd have to be asleep for me to get a hit off him. He looked up at Michael and said, and how do you know he's getting tired, by the way? You haven't had to hit against the guy. Trust me, Michael said. Two people here know how tired he is. Him and me. He's dropping his arm. When he's missing, like he did with Maria, he's not just missing his spots anymore. He's missing by a lot. You know how the announcers say a pitcher's going on fumes? The guy's going on fumes. You can put your bat on him, even if it's just for a bunt. I can't. Yes, you can, Michael said. The ump said, wrap it up, boys. Michael told Bobby, listen up. Here's what we're going to do. Is this Mr. M's idea? Bobby said. No, Michael said. It's mine. Then he watched Bobby walk back to the batter's box, shaking his head, like he was being sent to his room. Michael leaned in, made sure the Robins' third baseman wasn't listening, and told Maria what the play was. Then got back into the coach's box, clapped his hands, and said, come on, Bobby, let's do it. Corey Allen checked Maria, then went into his windup. As he did, Bobby Cameron squared to bunt. Just about every member of the Robins, and what sounded like half the neighborhood, yelled, he's bunting! Their first baseman charged. Their third baseman charged. Corey Allen charged from the mound. He didn't need to. Bobby bunted at the ball and missed it by about 2 feet. Now, Corey Allen was the one shaking his head as he walked back to the mound, like he couldn't figure out what Bobby was thinking. Trying some kind of squeeze play on him with 2 outs? Michael leaned toward Maria and said, same deal. Bobby squared again. Nobody needed to yell this time. Everybody just charged the way they did the pitch before, and then watched as Bobby missed again. 0-2 count. Michael looked across at Mr. M, standing there in the first base coach's box, arms out, palms up, not looking at Bobby, looking at Michael again, clearly mouthing these words, what are you doing? Ignoring him, Michael took 2 steps toward third base, said to Maria, be ready to run home when he puts this one in play. Maria was watching Corey Allen. Out of the side of her mouth, she said, when he puts the ball in play? Michael told her what he told Bobby Cameron, trust me. Bobby squared this time before Corey Allen even went into his windup. Corey almost looked bored as he made the little rocking motion just before throwing the ball. It wasn't until Corey's right arm started to come forward that Bobby jumped back into his regular stance the way Michael had told him to, got his bat back. The pitch had nothing on it because Corey didn't think he had to put anything on it. He didn't even care whether or not Bobby was dumb enough to be bunting with 2 strikes. Except Bobby Cameron, though, seeing the easiest pitch to hit he was ever going to see in his life, especially from a pitcher this good, was hitting away, putting his bat on the ball the way Michael had told him he would, slapping the ball to the left of the Robins' third baseman, who was coming down toward the plate as hard as he had on the first two pitches, and couldn't stop himself in time, or get his glove out in time. As the ball went past him, he looked a little bit, Michael thought, like a hockey goalie failing to make a glove save. The ball was past him then, barely making it to the infield dirt next to third base. Maria was already across home plate when the Robins shortstop, racing for the ball, picked it up barehanded and threw so wildly across the diamond trying to get Bobby at first, Bobby running as fast as he ever had on his little soccer legs, that Michael thought for a moment the ball might end up one-hopping the Major Deegan Expressway. Clippers 1, Robins 0. Game over. Michael felt happy for everybody on the team. He really did. And for a few seconds there at the end, when he was halfway between third and home, running right along with Maria as she tore for the plate, watching their third baseman roll himself over on the grass so he could watch the ball slowly roll away from him, Michael almost felt as if he was in the game. Almost. And he had to admit to himself that it didn't stink watching the Robins coach start yelling at everybody at once, even if nobody on the Robins had done anything wrong. They hadn't lost the game. The Clips had just won it. "How many times have we worked on situations like this?" His face turned into one of the big fat tomatoes Mrs. C was always bringing back from the Imperial for one of her special sauces. "How many times?" Right, Michael thought. The old two-strike, two-out, runner-on-third, fake, squeeze, and swing-away play. We work on that baby all the time. Michael walked away from the Robins' bench, across the infield, stopped at the pitcher's mound, found himself going there like it was the most natural place in the world for him to be. Watched the Clippers' celebration from there. Half the guys were still around Maria. Manny, Michael couldn't help noticing, looked more excited at having a good reason to hug Maria than he was about winning the game. The rest of the Clips were in a pig pile over behind first base, little Bobby Cameron finally crawling out from underneath them, looking happier in that moment than Michael had ever seen him on a baseball field. Bobby looked at Michael standing there on the mound then, pointed at him, and didn't say anything, just mouthed one word. "You." Michael shook his head, pointed his finger back at Bobby, mouthed these words right back at him. "No, you." Then he felt a hand on his shoulder and turned to see Mr. M right behind him on the mound. "I know you don't want to hear this," Mr. M said, "and I know it could never be enough for you, Michael, but you did as much as anybody to win this game."
"Players win the game, coach," he said. "You tell us that all the time. You tell us that it doesn't matter whether it's Little League or the Yankees. It's a player's game, don't you?"
Mr. M said, "I do."
"Anthony won the game for us tonight by pitching the way he did. Kel pitched out of that jam against Corey Allen. Maria worked him for a walk when we needed a base runner. Then Bobby finally did something he told me he couldn't do. That was the coolest part of all. As cool as them beating those guys."
Mr. M tried to correct him. "Us beating those guys."
Michael grinned then and did a Manny, made his two thumbs and two index fingers into the W that every single member of the Clippers knew meant one thing.
"Whatever." "Okay," Mr. M said, "you got me there. But I do have one piece of information that is guaranteed to make you feel better. That coach over there with the other team, Mr. Bender, the one pouting like a kid who just lost his video game privileges?"
Michael turned on the mound. The Robins must have cleared away from the bench as soon as he stopped yelling at them. Now he was sitting at the end of the bench all by himself, staring at the Clippers players still celebrating on the field as if they were already going to Williamsport.
"I thought it got quieter over there all of a sudden," Michael said.
Mr. M said,
"He's one of the coaches who signed the complaint about you
and your birth certificate, and has been telling everybody there's no way you can be 12.
But he doesn't even know me, Michael said.
We know him, though, don't we? Mr. M said. Him and all coaches like him.
Michael stared at the Robins coach. He belongs in the loser's bracket.
Yeah, he does, Mr. M said. And you helped put him there. So smile a little.
Michael did. But Mr. M was right. It wasn't enough. He went over and gave Bobby a high five, and Kel, and then Maria. Manny came running at him, and Michael knew what was coming next. The kind of flying chest bump the NBA players now did when you saw them being introduced before the game.
I knew you'd think of something, Manny said.
Bobby's the one who got the run home.
Yeah, but you got the assist, bud.
Manny's mom had brought homemade chocolate chip cookies and Gatorade boxes for the snack. When everybody started to rip into the cookies, Michael turned and started walking toward the stadium, where the Yankee game had either just started or was about to start. By the time he crossed the McCombs basketball courts, he could hear the PA music from inside and could see people who had gotten caught in traffic or had just come late to the ballpark running for the turnstiles. As usual, he could feel the excitement that seemed to be coming through the stadium's old walls, crashing right through them, even though it was just an August game against the Seattle Mariners.
This was one of those nights when he wanted to be inside even more than he usually did.
He didn't want to listen on the radio tonight. What he really wanted to do was sprint right up the hill, sprint past the security people working the turnstile at the press gate, blow right past them before they could stop him, and head for the nearest entrance to the field. Go all the way down to those choice seats near the field where he had spotted Ellie on television that time. Tonight, he wanted to be on the inside, just once in his life. One more dream just out of his reach, to go along with all the rest.
Michael didn't run anywhere. Nobody runs home to an empty apartment, he thought. Nobody runs to be alone.
He went up the hill, crossed Rupert Place, made his way through the crowd, moved along the outside of the stadium the way he did sometimes, dragging his hand lightly against the wall, close enough to touch. Everybody else was rushing past him in the other direction, trying to get to their seats in time for the first pitch. From inside, Michael could hear a woman beginning to sing the national anthem. Michael kept going toward 161st. It was there, the corner of 161st and Rupert, that he looked up, like this was another bad dream, not wanting to believe his eyes, and saw the two policemen walking Ramon the purse dealer toward the white van with NYPD written in huge blue letters on the side. And not just Ramon. Carlos, too.
Chapter 24.
Michael didn't know what to do. He stood there, like he was frozen in place, like he was back at school and they were playing freeze in the yard at recess. He didn't know whether to just run the other way, or yell out to his brother, or just walk over there and explain to the policeman that there had to be some kind of mistake. Was Carlos being arrested? And if that was true, what had he done to get arrested? And what in the world was he doing with Ramon? Carlos had said he was going to work at Hector's, like he did 5 nights a week and sometimes more, because he had told them to always call if one of the other busboys didn't show up for work. Now the tall black policeman had his hand on Carlos's shoulder. He wasn't shoving him toward the van exactly. Marching him in that direction was more like it. A smaller policeman was doing the same with Ramon the purse dealer. Michael could see Ramon talking away, the way he had talked and talked to Officer Crandall the day Michael's throw had taken him down in the outfield. Every few steps, Michael saw, Ramon would stop and turn his head and say something, and the smaller cop would give him a push and Ramon would keep going. Carlos didn't seem to be saying anything. just kept his head down with what Michael knew was his Washington Senator's cap on his head. Carlos, who had never done anything wrong in his life, who had never gotten a single detention in school. Carlos, who worked practically all the time so he and Michael could stay together. And now Michael stood there and didn't know if these policemen were taking his brother away in some sort of portable jail. But why? The van, the size of a small bus, was closer to the subway station than it was to McCombs. Michael followed them toward it, keeping what he thought was a safe distance, afraid that at any moment, Carlos might turn around and see him. And what do I do if Carlos does see me? Michael thought. He wanted to do something to help. It's what he thought a brother should do. He just didn't know what. Where was Manny when he really needed him? Michael had never paid much attention to the white van before, just knew it was always there for Yankee games, sitting there at the curb, part of the scenery on game nights the way the outside vendors were. He had never seen it arrive, was never around late enough to see when it left. He had no idea what was inside. He thought about going home as fast as he could, telling Mrs. C what had happened, seeing if she would know what to do, then coming right back. But then he wouldn't know if Carlos was still inside or if they'd taken him someplace else. He had some change in his pocket and even thought about going to the payphone at the bottom of the subway steps and actually calling Manny, hoping that he could come up with some bright idea. After all, wasn't it Manny who had come up with the idea of a fake dad? Or maybe that's what I should do, Michael thought. Call my fake dad, Uncle Timo, the way kids called their real dad when they were in trouble. An hour ago, it seemed like the worst thing that could possibly happen to him tonight was running Kel into that out at home plate against the Robins. The smaller policeman walked Ramon up some stairs and into the van. Carlos and the tall policeman stayed outside, Carlos with his head still down. The policeman pointing a finger at him and doing all the talking, Carlos just nodding his head sometimes. Ever since Papi died, Michael and Carlos had joked to each other that they had to stay one step ahead of the law. Not anymore. For the first time, Michael noticed what was written on the side of the white van in small blue letters underneath a huge picture of a badge and the huge letters that said NYPD. Prisoner Transport Trailer. Michael waited. He had decided that if Carlos didn't come out in the next few minutes, he was going to walk over to the van, knock on the door, and ask to see his brother. Just then, the door opened and Carlos came out, followed by the policeman. Carlos hesitated for a second and in that moment looked straight at Michael, as if he knew Michael had been there all along. Michael started to wave to his brother. Carlos shook his head. Michael pulled his arm down, stayed right where he was. Carlos came down the steps. The policeman followed him. Then the policeman was talking very hard to Carlos again, wagging his finger in front of his face, like he was saying, "Don't ever let me catch you here again." Carlos just kept nodding right along with him. Then an amazing thing happened. Amazing to Michael, anyway. The policeman shook Carlos's hand and pointed toward River Avenue, like he was telling Carlos to go home. Like he was letting him go. Still, Michael didn't move. Carlos waved back at the policeman and walked toward the subway station, crossed River without looking back as Michael heard a huge cheer, what sounded like a Yankee home run cheer from inside the stadium. He didn't understand what he had just seen. He didn't know what had happened to Ramon the purse dealer, and didn't care. He didn't know what he was supposed to do now. So he started walking home, hoping that was where Carlos was going. No jail, Michael thought. There was another cheer from inside, as big as before. Back-to-back home runs, maybe? Michael wanted to cheer too.
No jail.
They were in Mrs. C's apartment. She had made them both fried egg sandwiches with crispy bacon and some kind of jalapeno cheese that was a little spicy for Michael. Not that he would ever admit that in front of Mrs. C or his brother. She was even letting them have soft drinks. Coke in those small bottles that Poppy always said made the soda taste much better than plastic bottles or cans. Carlos had been doing all the talking. Mrs. C said she had told him when he called from what she thought was a real police station to come knock on her door whenever he got home, even if it was the middle of the night. She was the one Carlos had called when the tall policeman, his name, according to Carlos, was Officer McRae, had told him he had to contact an adult or guardian. That was when Officer McRae was still playing the part of what Carlos called bad cop, acting for all the world as if Carlos was going to be arraigned as an adult in the night court at the Bronx County Courthouse that would be in session in a few hours, where Officer McRae told him he would be given a court date and released in his own recognizance. You know what that means, Miguel? Michael said he did, from all the times watching Law and Order with his brother. I know what you're thinking, Carlos said. I finally ended up in one of our favorite shows.
It's not what I was thinking, Michael said. I was just thinking I'm glad we're here together.
Carlos told him the whole story then, meeting Ramon on the street after he got laid off from Hector's, Ramon telling him how much money a person could make scalping tickets if you knew how to do it right, Ramon finally talking him into it, Carlos telling himself he was only going to do it until he could find a better job.
But why? Michael said. Because I couldn't pay the bills, Carlos said, his eyes getting all red again, the way they had when Michael had run into their own apartment when he got back to 825 Girard, run right across the room and hugged Carlos the way he hardly ever did.
Because, Carlos said, if I paid electricity 1 month, then I had to wait until the next month to pay the phone, because I felt like one of those jugglers with the painted faces we used to see at El Guinol Nacional, Miguel. I tried, hombre. I really tried.
You should have told me, Michael said. Maybe I could have helped out.
You never said anything, Mrs. C said.
The man of the house isn't supposed to, Carlos said.
Only when he is too proud, she said, wagging her finger at him the way Officer McRae had in front of the prisoner transport van.
Poppy never asked anybody for help, Carlos said.
And one day it helped kill him.
Michael didn't even realize the words were inside his head until he heard himself saying them.
Carlos whipped his head around and Michael was afraid he was going to get yelled at for saying something like that. But his brother smiled instead.
Sometimes I think you're the older brother, Carlos said.
Maybe that's why they think I'm too old for Little League.
No, Carlos said.
It is because of the old soul Papi always said you had.
Michael had never understood what that meant, an old soul. Just knew Papi used to say it all the time, before he would lean down and give Michael one of those kisses with his scratchy beard. Carlos pounded his fist on Mrs. C's kitchen table.
I could have ruined everything, he said. Going for easy money.
Ramon, he said, had showed him the moves. How to discreetly hold up two fingers as though making an old-fashioned peace symbol, looking for the eye contact that meant somebody was interested. Told him to always be suspicious of any fan walking into the stadium by himself and still seemed interested in buying two tickets. Because sometimes that meant you had run into an undercover cop from the stadium detail. Ramon had told Carlos that if that happened, if he even thought he had been made, to get ready to run, and to always have the escape route he wanted to use mapped out inside his head. Tonight, it wasn't just one fan, as things turned out. It was a young couple, a man and a woman, both in Yankee home jerseys, saying they were in the upper deck and were hoping to move a little closer to the planet Earth, if that was at all possible. They were both from the Yankee Stadium detail, pulled out their badges before Carlos could run or do anything, showed their badges to him just as two other plainclothes cops were grabbing Ramon about 100 yards away near the giant replica of a baseball bat on Rupert Place. The man and the woman then handed him over to Officer McRae, who walked him to the van.
"What happened to Ramon?"
Michael said.
"What Officer McRae said was going to happen to me. They took him to night court. Ramon must have forgotten to tell me he'd been caught once before and given a warning, been told exactly what would happen to him if they ever caught him again."
"Fast runner, this Ramon," Mrs. C said. "Slow learner."
"Two strikes and you're out," Michael said.
Carlos said, "Something like that." Ramon had been taken to one part of the van, Carlos to another. Carlos told Officer McRae as much truth as he could, that his father was away and that he had been holding down two jobs and had lost one of them, then been dumb enough to listen to somebody like Ramon. Finally, after Officer McRae felt he had scared him enough, he told Carlos he was releasing him because of what he called officer's discretion. "When he got me outside," Carlos said, "he told me that if he ever saw me at Yankee Stadium again, I better be handing the ticket in my pocket over to somebody at one of the turnstiles." Carlos looked at Michael.
"I am so sorry, little brother."
Michael had never seen his big brother cry, not even over Papi, but he was afraid he might now. Mrs. C spoke before Michael could.
"Sorry for what?" she said. "Scalping is against the law. Loving your brother is not."
Chapter 25. Two nights later, Chris Norse pitched the best he had all year, regular season or All-Stars, and the Clippers won again, beating the Grand Concourse Condors 5-2. Somehow, even without Michael, the Clippers seemed to be getting on a roll.
"Since you can't pitch, we shouldn't have enough pitching," Manny said. "But right now, we have enough pitching."
Michael looked at him. "You don't just play Yogi Berra's position," he said. "You're starting to sound like him." Norse went the first 5 innings, throwing nothing but fastballs. Kel pitched the 6th, throwing anything but fastballs. Anthony Fierro hit a home run over the fence in dead center, a 3-run job, catching a fastball from the Condor starter right on the sweet spot. Manny scored 3 runs and talked Norse through every single jam. The worst was probably in the top of the 4th. The game was still 2-2, and the Condors had the bases loaded. But then, Norse pitched his way out of it with 2 strikeouts. Before Michael went to coach 3rd, in the bottom of the 4th, Manny sat down next to him on the bench as he started to take off his chest guard.
"It's nice to have a pitcher who doesn't act like he might break out in a rash if we have an occasional conversation on the mound," Manny said.
Michael said, "By conversation, does that mean Chris gets to talk too? Because I don't recall seeing his lips moving when you were out there chattering away." Manny made a snorting sound.
"There are all sorts of ways people can communicate."
"Yeah," Michael said, "but there's only one you really like."
"Which is?"
"You talk, the rest of us listen." Anthony hit his 3-run shot in the bottom of that inning, and that had done it. They'd won again. Michael stayed around after the game. Carlos was back working at Hector's for the next few nights. They'd called him because 2 of the waiters, who had been serving as busboys, were out sick. Manny had gotten permission from his mom to spend the night with Michael, even though she knew that Carlos wouldn't be home until late. While they were eating their snack after the game, Michael thought for a second he saw Ellie watching from the top of the hill. Not right above the basketball courts, more toward the corner of 161st and Rupert. But when he went to get Manny, to see if he thought it was her, whoever it was at the top of the hill was gone.
"The Yankees don't get back from Boston until tomorrow," Manny said. "She never shows up when they don't have a game."
"And her father isn't pitching."
"Maybe you're seeing things," Manny said. "Wishful thinking, dude."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"You know exactly what it means," Manny said. You know you want to see her.
Kel came by, his mouth full of ice cream sandwich.
See who?
Nobody, Michael said, giving Manny a squinty-eyed look.
Kel said, Michael got a sweetie.
Michael said to Manny,
Tell him I don't have a sweetie.
Manny grinned.
Okay, I don't have a sweetie.
Now Kel grinned.
What?
Maria don't count?
Shut up,
Manny said. When he got a line that worked for him, he stayed with it. Michael had to give him that. He did want to see Ellie, in the worst way, even if he would never admit that to Manny or anybody else. He wanted to tell her he was sorry for being mean to her that day. He wanted to tell her that if he ever got to pitch another big game, he wanted her to be there to see it. In his head, it was always the game at Yankee Stadium, the one Manny wouldn't let him talk about for fear of jinxing the Clippers, the game that would get them to Williamsport. That was the game he wanted Ellie to see. Michael standing wherever they would put the mound for a Little League game, bringing his own heat in the same place her father brought his. Out of all his dreams, this was the one he liked the best, even if it seemed to be the one most out of his reach, the way Ellie was out of his reach. How could he get to her? Was she still coming to watch every time her father pitched? Or did she stay away from the stadium the way she was staying away from Michael and Manny? Did he want to wait outside the blue barriers and call her name when she walked into the ballpark with her father? If he did that, would she stop to talk to him? Or just keep walking? Manny always said it was much easier to figure out slugging percentages than it was to figure out girls. Maybe, Michael thought, he could ask the guard at Yankee Stadium to give her a message if he got over to the ballpark early enough, before the crowds began to form behind the blue barriers in the late afternoon. Oh, right. Just walk up and hand the man a note and tell him to make sure to give it to El Grande's daughter when the two of them arrived. If she was with El Grande when he arrived, like that was ever going to happen on this planet. Sometimes, he pictured himself taking the train up to Riverdale, but he could never figure out the next part. Ask somebody at the station for directions to El Grande's house? There was no game for the Clippers that night. No practice. Their next game wasn't until the end of the week, Friday probably, depending on what happened with the loser's bracket game. Manny wasn't around. He'd gone into the city with his mother to see Uncle Timo in the rehearsal for what Manny called an off Broadway play.
If it were any more off Broadway, they'd be putting it on inside the Lincoln Tunnel, Manny said,
and wouldn't be back until tonight. They'd invited Michael to join them. Manny said it was a comedy, but Michael didn't feel much like laughing today. And he didn't need Manny and his mom telling him that things were going to work out, just wait and see. He needed to come up with a plan. A plan to see Ellie again. At 2:30, a little before the first Yankee players began to show up for a night game, he sat down at the kitchen table and wrote out the note and stuffed it in his pocket and headed for Yankee Stadium. He didn't have a real plan yet. It was like the ghost captain said in Pirates of the Caribbean when he was explaining to Captain Jack that something wasn't actually a pirate code. What Michael really had was more like guidelines. Sometimes, even if the Yankees weren't playing one of the top teams or their hated rival, the Red Sox, the crowds still began to form early between the players' parking lot and the players' entrance. Today was one of those days. By the time Michael made his way to the blue barrier, the fans were already 6 or 7 deep. He figured that the way things were going for him in his life, El Grande would already be inside the stadium, even though he only showed up this early when it was his turn to pitch. But when he asked a boy in a Yankee cap if he'd seen El Grande yet, the boy said,
Nah,
and I got here at 2 o'clock before the manager even showed up.
You're sure?
Michael said. No, the boy said. I decided to trick the first kid who asked me.
Sorry,
Michael said. Joe Johnson was the first Yankee to arrive after Michael got there. He wore a colorful Hawaiian-looking shirt
and baggy shorts and sandals, and dark sunglasses so big Michael thought he was worried about death rays from outer space. The people around Michael seemed to scream in one voice, "Joe!" Then everybody was shouting something different. "Joe! Over here, Joe!
Sign this ball, Joe!
Come on, Joe! I've been waiting all season!
Please, Joe!
For my son, Joe!" Like these were the words to some crazy song, all the words running together, people yelling their heads off like they were warming up for the game. Though Michael always wondered how many of the people out here had tickets to the game, and how many were like him and never made it inside. Michael noticed the boy next to him had disappeared. Maybe he was up at the front, reaching with the baseball and pen he'd had in his hands along with everybody else. Michael wasn't watching Joe Johnson now. He was watching the parking lot. Lot 14. Darren Rogers, the team's rookie shortstop, an all-star already, was the next Yankee out of the lot. Then the Yankees closer, Dave Worth, looking like a tight end, or maybe a power forward in the NBA. 6'6", and at least 250 pounds. Then, the other Cuban-born player on this year's Yankees, Orlando Gasa, the little leadoff man and left fielder who was hitting .330 and leading the league in runs scored. All his Yankee heroes. Only today, he wasn't interested in heroes. All he wanted today was a father. And not even his own. Ellie's. Maybe that was what finally changed his luck. Because 5 minutes later, El Grande showed up. Michael recognized the shiny black Mercedes-Benz from all the other times he had seen it pull into Lot 14 in the afternoon. El Grande had the windows of the front seat all the way down, and even from where Michael stood in the middle of the blue barrier crowd, he could hear the music from inside the car. The loud horns from what had to be the Cuban jazz the announcer said El Grande loved. Maybe it was the music of the Buena Vista Social Club. The announcers always said they were his favorite group.
Grande!
Somebody yelled it, and then everybody turned in the direction of the Mercedes at once.
Grande! Grande! Grande!
Michael stepped back out of the crowd, toward the Yankee souvenir store, trying to give himself some room. But room to do what? He had come here thinking he could get El Grande to give Ellie a message for him. Only now that El Grande had arrived, he wasn't sure what he would do, even if he were in front of all these people shouting El Grande's name instead of behind them. How many times have you seen him walk past you and the rest of these people without even glancing in this direction? Michael thought. He saw the Mercedes ease into one of the spots in Lot 14 closest to Rupert Place, right next to where the Yankee manager had parked. He saw the dark-tinted windows to the car go up. He saw El Grande, wearing some sort of long white shirt out of his slacks, step out of the car, carrying only his car keys. El Grande shook hands with the two security guards posted at both sides of the open gate to the lot, then walked slowly across Rupert, which was barely wider than a sidewalk. The people in the crowd got louder, almost sounding desperate to get his attention. Michael began to weave his way through the people in front of him as El Grande stopped to chat with a policeman. The people were so fixed on El Grande that they didn't notice Michael sliding this way and that, like a running back in football finding a hole in the line. Somehow, Michael barely touched them. Carlos used to joke that Michael was the one who should be carrying trays to the restaurant, that he was so graceful he could carry a full glass of water through a crowded subway train without spilling a drop. Now or never, he told himself. Michael reached into his pocket and felt the folded piece of paper, the note to Ellie with his phone number at the bottom. Dear Ellie, I am sorry I hurt your feelings. I guess I was having a bad day and took it out on you. Please call. Your friend, I hope, Michael Arroyo. He got to the blue barriers as El Grande shook hands with the policeman, whom Michael saw was Officer Jasper McRae, the one with Carlos that night. El Grande was maybe 20 yards from the entrance to the stadium. The people around him were still yelling his nickname.
Mr. Gonzalez!
Michael yelled, as loud as he had ever yelled in his life, trying to make himself heard, trying something different, hoping he would catch his ear. El Grande didn't turn. Michael felt like a swimmer doing a jackknife dive, bent over the blue barrier like he was, bent almost in half, certain if anybody touched him from behind, he would fall right over.
Mr. Gonzalez, over here, it's important!
Knowing even as he said it that his voice was being drowned out by all the other voices, all of them trying to get El Grande Gonzalez's attention, all of them failing. El Grande was nearly to the entrance. Last chance.
El gato misifus!
Michael yelled now. Louder than ever, his throat feeling as if it were about to explode. The cat misifus, from the children's song Papi used to sing to Michael, the same one Ellie said her father loved to sing to her when she couldn't sleep. El Grande stopped, tilted his head slightly in their direction.
Vamos a ver quién va a tocarle a misifus el corazón,
Michael yelled again. Let's see who can get to misifus's heart.
Say what? A voice from behind Michael said. What did the boy say just now?
Another voice asked, and finally somebody said,
Corazón, who's he play for?
And all around Michael, people laughed. He didn't care. El Grande was walking toward the blue barrier now, staring into it, like he was curious about something. All around him, they started calling out to him again, but El Grande hushed them by putting a finger to his lips. Now, only Michael spoke.
Misifus dormido en su cama está.
Misifus is sleeping on his bed.
Who is talking to me about Misifus the cat?
El Grande asked, his eyes scanning the crowd. Only 6 feet away from Michael now, just up the line, Michael smiled as if he had uncovered a secret. El Grande never answered the reporter's questions in English. Michael knew from reading the papers. He always used a translator, but now he was asking one in English. Michael felt as tongue-tied now as the day when he had first met El Grande's daughter, but he slowly raised his hand, the good boy in class again.
I did,
he said, his voice sounding so weak it was as if it were coming from across the street. El Grande walked over to where Michael was standing. From both sides of Michael, the people reached toward El Grande with baseballs and caps and t-shirts and autograph books and posters and old game programs and magic markers. Most of them probably thinking what Michael was thinking in this moment, that this might be as close as they ever got to El Grande Gonzalez in their lives. El Grande put a finger to his lips again. All went silent. Michael was certain all those close to him, El Grande included, could hear the pounding of his heart.
El ratón puede tener corazón para reír, para cantar, para bailar,
El Grande said in a soft voice, looking down at Michael. It was the part in the song about the mouse, Michael the mouse, what Papi used to call Michael, the little mouse in the song who loved to laugh, to sing, to dance. Michael said the next line from the song, somehow able to get the words out. Maybe because they never felt as true as they did right now.
Las cosas son realmente malas.
Things are really bad. El Grande nodded, then put out his right hand for Michael to shake it. Michael did, slipping the note to him as he did. He was about to explain who he was, why he was giving him the note, but now the words wouldn't come. And then El Grande was turning away, walking back toward the player's entrance as the people all around Michael were shouting again, El Grande not even looking at what Michael had handed him, just sticking the piece of paper in the pocket of his pants before he disappeared inside Yankee Stadium. Chapter 26. Manny said this was the way it had to work out. The Clippers against the Westchester South Giants in the semifinals. Winner making it to the District 22 finals a week from Friday night. The District 22 finals at Yankee Stadium. Winner going from there to Williamsport for the World Series.
Us against Justin the Jerk, basically, Manny said.
It had been 4 days since Michael had given his note to El Grande. Still, no word from Ellie. The Yankees had played 1 3-game series at home against the Royals and then hit the road again. 2 nights ago, the Clippers had made the semis by beating Harlem River Drive 8-7, Kel finally winning the game with an RBI single in the bottom of the sixth. Now, Michael and Manny were in Michael's apartment, killing time in the afternoon before the Westchester game. Batting practice at McCombs not until 5:30. They had the Yankees-Orioles game from Baltimore on the radio. The Yankees were losing again, the way they had the night before after El Grande had left the game with an ankle sprain, or something worse. Even now, the announcers weren't sure. All they knew was that in the bottom of the first, after rain had delayed the start of the game for a couple of hours, he had landed awkwardly on his left leg, which collapsed underneath him. The original thought was that it was just a high sprain, but that morning, they had decided to send him back to New York to see the Yankee team doctors and have an MRI, which would show whether he had done some ligament damage. The bad news just never stopped, Michael thought. Manny could always tell when Michael had stopped listening to him.
Are you more interested in the Yankee game or our game? He said.
I can't be interested in both?
Come on, you know you still want a piece of old Justin.
Yeah, only I won't be playing, Michael said. When you look at it that way, Justin and his dad have already beaten me. Somebody on the Orioles must have belted one into the gap because John Sterling, the Yankees radio announcer, was yelling about the ball rolling all the way to the wall. Manny reached over and turned down the sound.
Hey,
Michael said. Manny said,
I just want to say this one time today, and then I promised not to say it again. It should be you sticking it to Justin tonight.
There was no good answer to that, so Michael didn't say anything. There were a lot of differences between them, but this was the biggest. Manny always kept talking, whether he had something to say or not.
I was sure they would have found it by now, Manny said.
My birth certificate?
I thought that Mr. Gibbs guy was supposed to help.
He said he'd try, and he did, Michael said. He spoke to Carlos the other night, but all he could tell him was that he hadn't made any more progress in Havana than we had.
Great, Manny said.
Manny asked if Michael wanted to watch Little Big League, one of their favorite baseball movies, saying there was just enough time before BP for them to watch it all the way to the end. Because if you didn't see the end, you wouldn't know if everything came out all right, Michael said, even if it has all the other 9,000 times we've watched it.
It's why I love the movies, bud, Manny said. Gotta have those happy endings.
Manny pushed the tape into the VCR, came over, his face serious now, reached out and gave Michael a closed fist. Michael tapped it.
You really are due for a happy ending one of these days, Manny said.
They heard the phone just as soon as they closed the apartment door behind them. Manny kept walking down the hall, but Michael fumbled to get his key out of his pocket, thinking it might be Ellie. He got back into the apartment on the fourth ring and picked up the receiver, out of breath, only to hear that it was Mrs. C on the other end, telling him that she'd have a plate of pasta for him and Carlos after the game if they wanted it. Michael thanked her and hung up. When he caught up with Manny at the elevator, Manny just raised his eyebrows. Not her, Michael said. Forget it, he told himself now. Just do what you've always done and focus on the game, even if it's a game you're not playing. Beat Justin the Jerk and his dad and get inside Yankee Stadium finally, even if it wasn't the way you planned or dreamed. During the regular season, some of the Clippers and sometimes a lot of the Clippers would show up late for batting practice. Not today. When Michael and Manny got there at 5:15, the whole team except for Manny was already on the field.
Must be a big game or something, Manny said,
and grabbed his catcher's mitt out of his bat bag and went to warm up Anthony Fierro, who was waiting for him over by the Clippers bench. Anthony had pitched 3 innings of relief against Harlem River Drive, but had gotten 3 full days off now, which meant he could pretty much pitch tonight until his arm fell off, if they needed him to.
The players from Westchester South had gone to run some warm-up laps around the basketball courts. Mr. Minaya, who'd been pitching BP, had gone over to the fence and was talking on his cell phone. He put it down for a second and yelled for the guys and Maria to get out there for infield practice as long as Westchester was still running.
"Hey, Michael, you hit them grounders," he said.
Michael took his own bat out, hit a nice one-hopper to Chris Norris at third. The second time around the infield, he heard somebody yell,
"Hey, Arroyo!"
It was coming from the Westchester side. He turned and saw Justin leaning against the small chain-link fence that protected the visiting team's bench. Michael turned and pointed to himself.
"Yeah,"
Justin said.
"Hey,"
Michael said, not knowing what else to say to him.
"Shouldn't you be warming up by now?"
Justin said. Then, in a sarcastic way, he said,
"Oh, my bad. I forgot. You're too old to pitch in this league."
"You know I'm not," Michael said, then added, "and so does your father."
"Prove it,"
Justin said. Then he smacked his forehead and said,
"My bad again. You can't prove it, can you?"
At that point, a baseball smacked into the fence about a foot from Justin's head, the impact of it making him fall back and nearly fall down. Michael whipped around to see where it had come from and saw Manny standing halfway between home and first.
"Oops,"
he said. Then he rubbed his fingers together like a fly rubbing its wings.
"Darn thing must have slipped when I was trying to throw it to third."
Justin started around the fence like he was coming for Manny. But his father jumped up from the bench where he'd been writing in his scorebook and grabbed him from behind, putting him in a bear hug. It didn't stop Justin's big mouth.
"You want some of me?"
he yelled across the field at Manny. Manny turned his head and spit, then said,
"You have no idea."
Justin acted like he was trying to get loose from his dad, but everybody could see he really wasn't.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
he yelled.
"There you have it,"
Manny said to Michael, ignoring Justin now.
"The guy is totally clueless."
Justin's dad walked his son back to the bench, then came back and stood inside the fence, at the spot where he'd coached most of the last game his team had played against them. He pointed at Manny and said,
"Why don't you worry about your own team, son, and we'll worry about ours."
Michael thought, the dad has no clue either. If he thinks that's going to be the last word, he had a better chance of going across the street and managing the Yankees than he did getting the last word in on Manny Cabrera.
"It's like my mom says," Manny went on for all to hear. "The rotten apple never falls far from the tree."
"All right, Manny, that's enough,"
Mr. Minaya said now, stuffing his cell phone into the pocket of his pants. Manny tried to look innocent.
"I was just saying."
Mr. M sighed.
"Always."
Justin's dad said,
"You should do a better job of controlling your players, coach."
"I know," Mr. M smiled, but Michael knew it was like a clown smile somebody had painted on him.
"Don't you just hate it when boys act like boys?"
He motioned the